We are journeying through the days between Corpus Christi and the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart. After reading about fire coming down from heaven in the first reading, I was thinking maybe I should focus on the Sacred Heart, which is on fire. You know, it's the symbol of divine love, an intense fire, and that fire is what we see in the first reading. Well, it's a great reading, and we'll get to it in a minute, but let's start with today's Gospel. Here we are in the early part of the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus, who is about to speak about his way of fulfilling the commandments, you know the section, we'll get to it in a few days, although we have the feast days coming up, so I'm not sure what we'll get, but you know the section from the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, "You have heard it said such and such, but I say to you something more." And so before he does that, he wants to explain he's not doing away with the law or the prophets. He's not eliminating the great guidance that we receive from God in the law. Rather, he comes to fulfill the law. There are a number of different ways we can explain or describe why Jesus came or what he was up to. He himself usually spoke about doing the will of the Father. That was why he came, to do the will of the Father. But it was the will of the Father that he fulfill all that had been prophesied of him, the law and the prophets. So he's not coming to abolish the law. Now, when it comes to law, we can identify two extremes. On the one end, there's, you could say, extreme legalism, that fulfilling the letter of the law, the literal demand of the law, is what makes one righteous. That was the trap that the Pharisees tended toward, legalism. So they were not about to accept anybody who came along to abolish the law. That would be the worst possible thing to the mind of the Pharisees. The other extreme is what we might call lawlessness, meaning you don't have to follow any law at all. And this was more of a danger for those who recognized that the way of salvation was by faith in Jesus Christ. And we know this from some of the writings of St. Paul, that there were Christians who were saying, well, now that Jesus has saved us and we put our trust in him, it doesn't matter what we do. You know some of those passages where Paul says, what, well, now that we're saved by grace, we can sin? And he says, no. But you see the other extreme, so the lawlessness idea. Jesus has not come to impose legalism, neither has he come to establish lawlessness, kind of libertine mentality, do whatever you want now that you've been saved. No, he comes to fulfill the law, to bring the central purpose of the law to its completion. That is, to recognize that the law, which comes from the fire in the heart of God, it comes from love of God, is intended to make it possible for us to love better and better, to love more and more deeply. So if we take the legalism extreme, we're not living by love, we're living by law. And if we're taking the lawlessness extreme, we're not practicing love either, because we become trapped in our self-will and desires. That's what happens with people who throw off the law. They tend to decline into a kind of sensuality, pride. So Jesus is setting us free from these two extremes by revealing the deeper meaning of the law. Now we'll get to that as we go through the Sermon on the Mount. Now let's turn to the great story about Elijah and the prophets of Baal, the great contest on Mount Carmel. The Carmelites love this story because it shows that the establishment of the reign of God, and the Carmelites look to Elijah as their father. Anyway, so here it is, you know the story. Elijah is a prophet of the Lord, but the king and the queen are mixing up their service of the Lord with service of other gods, in particular Baal. And the people are taking the attitude, it seems, well, rather than choose one or the other, let's have both. We get the best of both worlds. We get the Lord, God of Israel, and we get Baal. We get the Lord to take care of us and protect us and set us free from our enemies. And then we have Baal to send rain and provide fertility for our livestock and fruitful harvests. That's what Baal did. So that's why when Elijah says, okay, make a choice. If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal, follow him. They don't make a choice. They want both. Which is wrong answer. Because Baal is not a real God. He's an idol. So Elijah sets up this contest between, it looks to us like a contest between the 450 and the one. But on a much deeper level, it's the contest between Baal and the Lord. It's good to see these two levels because on the human level, it looks like the prophets of Baal have the huge advantage. And that's the way it looks in the world. Worldly powers very often, I would say usually, look more powerful than those who rely on the Lord. That's why we get into these discussions about geopolitical tensions and who's got a bigger army and who's got better weapons and who's going to take over Taiwan and who's going to take over in the contest between the NATO and Russia and all these things. We think, well, who's more powerful? And we forget the heavenly level where God is the one with the power. So we see the 450 and we see the one and we say, well, obviously the 450 are more powerful. Not only are they more numerous, but they also have the support of the king, which Elijah doesn't have. So they have political power, they have a numerical power, they probably have more money, and Elijah has been living in absolute poverty, remember, being fed by a poor widow. So Elijah seems to have nothing going for him from the earthly perspective. And I just say, it's good to see it this way because this is often the way it looks. In the early church, the Christians identified themselves with Elijah because they were standing up against the power of Rome. And Rome with all its gods and with all its armies and with all its money. And the Christians who had nothing. So they felt like Elijah. Or you might turn to that other example of obvious a difference in power, the great story of David and Goliath. Goliath, the great champion of the Philistines, he was strong, he had weapons, he had been trained in war, and David was the little shepherd boy who had nothing. He didn't even have any armor, he had no training, and it looks like an obvious defeat is coming. Well, that's the way it looks like from an earthly perspective in the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. But then Elijah acts with extraordinary confidence that he's not relying on any human power. He's a representative of the Lord of all the earth, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who saves. Now, Elijah, you can understand why he has this confidence, because he's been living for years in this absolute dependence on God, and God has always taken care of him. We heard those stories, fed by the ravens, provided by the poor widow who had nothing except a little bit left. And she always had a little bit left for a year. And there are other stories which we've skipped over about Elijah and dramatic signs of divine power in his favor. So Elijah has confidence. You might even, he seems a little bit cocky, in fact, a little bit overconfident. Like, you know, he's teasing them, he's taunting them, he's filling the trench full of water, he's pouring water all over everything. It's as if he's going to make a huge show out of it. Now, he's right. So we're in Elijah's favor. But we know Elijah was not always that confident. In a few pages, another couple of chapters, we'll see Elijah in almost depression because he's being chased by the queen, and he doesn't have anybody in support of him, and he wants to give up. you know, those stories where he hides in the cave and then he hears the Lord in the tiny whispering sound. So Elijah, who's used to these big dramatic signs of divine power, has to be instructed, well, don't look for God in dramatic signs all the time. God is present in the tiny whispering sound. Anyway, that's a little bit later, but here it's a dramatic sign. And it's clear who the winner is. Not those with earthly power, but the Lord. Meaning Elijah because of the Lord. Who has power to send down fire from heaven? Not Baal. Who has power to change the course of human events? Not Baal. See, they turned to Baal for fertility, they prayed to him for rain, and they thought that he was the one providing for them. It was the Lord the whole time. This contest made it clear to the people, oh, I guess Baal must really be the Lord must be God, and Baal is not. So it's a great victory. But we have to remember that God does not always answer prayers with dramatic signs from heaven. He usually doesn't. Faith comes in when we put our trust in the Lord who has this power and is exercising it in ways that we don't always see. That's why it's important to have faith. If we are always going to be waiting around for divine signs, we're going to miss what God is doing at a much deeper and more powerful level, as Elijah himself seems to have struggled with later in his journey. So when there's no more signs, what happens to Elijah? He says, well, I'd be better off dying now. I'm a failure here. So that's the great story of the contest. What we're being instructed in here is to go beyond the superficial perspective, the idea of where power really lies, to go beyond the superficial interpretation of the law, to think that all we have to do is follow all the rules and then we'll be guaranteed an enjoyable life. No. The Lord is fulfilling his will. And those who want to experience the greatest fulfillment have to be abandoned to him. We do not put our trust in earthly power. As tempting as it can be, we don't put our trust in earthly power because ultimately it fails. We put our trust in the Lord, who ultimately is victorious.